questions in through the Q&A. And then if we have time at the end, we may offer up that hand raise feature. But until then, please keep the hands down and just use the Q&A to let us know if you need help with anything. All right, I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today's session. So at this point, I am very happy to turn the floor over to one of your instructors today, Emmy Laiha, who will be providing some overview and opening comments on the ongoing Federal Facilities Academy. Emmy, I'll turn it to you.
Thank you so much, Jean. So hopefully you all were able to also participate in last month's webinar. This is our second round of webinars for the Federal Facilities Academy. The Academy itself consists of 11 webinars and one in-class course. That's a three-day course. So if you decide to participate in this Academy, you can get credit or a certificate of completion for the entirety of the Academy. That comes from our Director of Federal Facilities here at EPA. And it just goes to show that you are going above and beyond to really understand federal facility cleanups and understand those unique aspects of federal facilities. So I highly encourage you to participate. Participation is voluntary, but it really is a great way to get all the nuances of federal facility cleanups under CERCLA. And yeah, the other thing I'll say, I think there's some questions about whether or not we archive these webinars, including this round for 2022, and those are available. If you missed, for example, last month's webinar, you can access the archived version for credit. And I'll give it over to Jean to talk about how you get credit for these.
All right. Thank you so very much, Emmy. So just as Emmy highlighted, this is part of an ongoing series. So there will be a series of webinars, one per month throughout the remainder of the year. The 11 online webinars are open to the public. So that means anyone is welcome to register and participate in those webinars, either live when we host them throughout the month, or replaying the archived versions that we'll be publicly posting on the Cluent archive. There is also an in-person classroom training that Emmy highlighted, which we'll talk a little bit more about later on. And the only way to participate is to actually attend that one if it is held in person. And that is open to a restricted audience. Again, only EPA states, tribes, and other federal agencies. So the classroom three-day training is not open to the public, but the 11 webinars are. Now, you can receive an individual participation certificate for each of the 11 webinars. After each webinar, I'll show you how to share feedback and how to request a certificate as soon as you send your feedback form in. So you can document your participation either by attending the webinars live or by replaying the recorded ones. Even watching an archived webinar, you can still send in feedback and get a participation certificate based off of your replay. So if you are trying to go for that Academy certificate, I encourage you to be sure to get a certificate for each one of the 11 webinars and save that for your records. And then again, if you're able and eligible to attend that in-person training and you've done all 11 webinars, after you've completed the in-person training, you will get that Academy certificate indicating you've done everything. If you can only attend some or only wish to attend some of those webinars, that is perfectly okay. You can pick and choose and sit in online at your availability and interest. So I will come back and remind everybody about certificates and how to get to them later. So until then, I think, Emmy, are we ready to get started with our content today?
Yes, let's go ahead.
All right, so I've called up the presentation materials and I will turn the floor back to you.
All right, thank you so much, Jean. Hello, everyone. My name is Emerald Laiha. I go by Emmy for short, and I work here at our EPA headquarters in the Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Office. Today's webinar is focusing on records of decisions, or RODs, and more at federal facilities. So we're going to go over all the different types of decision documents that can be used and talk about how some of those are interconnected. Just one second here while I get my slides moving. Before we jump into the content, I would really like to get a sense of how much experience you all have with these types of decision documents. So if you could just typing in the Q&A box, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, if you could just go ahead and let me know, besides a ROD, what other types of cleanup decisions have you been involved with as part of the CERCLA process?
And so again, you're going to look for that Q&A box to type in your responses to this particular question, and I'll begin summarizing the answers as they're coming in. So Emmy, a number of participants have commented and noted action memos or action memorandums. Some of them are chiming in with ESDs, which is an acronym for, if I'm not mistaken, explanation of significant differences.
Yes.
And then a few have said none, or some of them are just indicating they're brand new, so they just don't have a lot of experience. Some are mentioning they've done EECAs, RCSCs, RIs, removal actions, interim rods, early actions. So a whole slew of experience levels back there.
All right. Well, that's helpful for me just to get a sense. We're going to go over everything, but it's good to know that there is a lot of different levels of experience on the webinar today. That's great. So as far as what we're going to discuss today, we will be focusing on federal facility sites that are listed on the National Priority List, or the NPL. Then we will focus in first on removal actions, early actions, talk about rods, difference between a final rod and an interim rod, as well as those changes that might occur after a rod is in place, those post-rod decisions. And we'll wrap it up with a brief touch on adaptive management and five-year reviews. So let's go ahead and jump right into it. The main point of this course is to really help you understand how these different cleanup decisions can complement each other, how removal actions can support your overall cleanup, what those interim actions can do, all the way through your rod and your five-year reviews if those are being done at your site. So let's talk about how they help each other. First, we'll start off with just an introduction to CERCLA. So this was passed in 1980, commonly referred to as Superfund, and then it was amended by the Superfund Amendments and Reauthorization Act in 1986. And that's where it authorized the president to respond to releases or threatened releases of hazardous substances to the environment. I mean, that's really the whole point of CERCLA, is to go after this hazardous waste and clean it up to remove any unacceptable risk. So based on CERCLA and the National Contingency Plan, the NCP, and Executive Order 12580, if you're not familiar with that order, you do have a link to it in the related links materials if you'd like to read through it. That's really important because Executive Order 12580 identified that at the Department of Defense and Department of Energy sites, they are acting as the lead agency, while EPA is providing oversight in accordance with federal facility agreements, often along with the state, but also as a party to those FFAs. So that's just to get our orientation. Let's take a closer look at the NCP that states what the lead agency is. So that is the agency that's providing on-scene coordinators or remedial project managers. And as I just mentioned, for Department of Defense sites, that's going to be, you know, DOD is going to be the lead agency. At DOE sites, they're the lead agency, and other federal agencies as identified. So for sites other than those of EPA or the U.S. Coast Guard, DOD or DOE, then that other federal agency is the lead agency for remedial actions and removal actions other than emergencies. If it is a urgent removal action that has to be done in a matter of days, then often that lead agency is going to be responsible for cleaning it up. So if you've ever looked at CERCLA or read through it, you should know that Section 120 is specific to federal facilities. And it essentially says that federal facilities are subject to CERCLA to the same extent as private entities. So it's like, okay, same, same, but with the nuances, it's kind of same, different when it comes to this Section 120. So federal agencies, we just talked about how lead agencies other than EPA are going to be the lead agencies at these federal facility sites, they still have to comply with all the guidelines, rules, regulations, and criteria that are identified under CERCLA. And these lead agencies shall not adopt guidelines inconsistent with those established by the EPA administrator. So if a federal agency has its own guidance that is inconsistent with EPA guidance, then that guidance should not be used in moving forward through the CERCLA process to determine what a remedy should be. So they cannot be inconsistent. That's not a choice. That is what the regs say. Something else that's unique for federal facilities is that individuals and states can bring citizen suits if the agency is not following CERCLA at federal facilities. So if there's a requirement in the NCP that the lead agency is failing to meet, then a citizen suit can be brought, be it from an individual or from the state. One other thing I really want to clarify, because I think there's some misunderstanding of this, is who gets to select the remedy? Is it the lead agency? Is it a regulatory agency? Like, ask yourself that question and answer it for yourself. For me, I'm like, oh, well, EPA, but I might be biased because I work for EPA, right? So EPA and the federal agency, that lead agency, jointly select remedies. But the one thing I want you to keep in mind is that you cannot have a record of decision without EPA signature. So sometimes you hear federal facility RPMs or maybe their state counterparts say, oh, well, that's the lead agency's remedy, not ours. Well, actually, for EPA, it is also our remedy because we need to sign off on that record of decision. So that's what makes regulatory oversight very, very important when it comes to signing that name on the dotted line. So something to keep in mind. In the event that the lead agency wants to do a certain type of remedy and EPA does not agree, ultimately the authority falls back to EPA if there's a dispute. So again, it is a jointly selected remedy. It's not simply EPA concurring or the state concurring with the remedy, it's actually approving it. All right, let's go to the next slide here. So this is a slightly busy flowchart. I do want to point out in your participant manuals, the last page is a full blow up of this flowchart if you want to reference it. I know it's hard to read that tiny print, especially as we get older. But we put together this flowchart just to take a look at the CERCLA remedial process and how different aspects of it complement each other. So we are starting from here. Sites that are listed on the MPL, federal facility sites. Typically, once you're at that point, you're moving forward with your remedial investigation and feasibility studies. Typically at federal facility sites, they're really large. So you don't have just a single decision, but you'll have multiple decisions that cover a range of operable units. And those processes might be at different points in the CERCLA process, but you have your RIFS. At that point in time, as you're collecting data or better understanding the contamination you have at site, you may realize that it makes sense to use removal actions, or even perhaps if you're, well, this would be if you're not listed on the MPL, you might look at another cleanup approach, like a voluntary state cleanup program or something like that. But once you're on the MPL and you've done your RAFS, you might look at removal actions or interim actions as part of your cleanup process. In pursuing a ROG, you're going to issue that proposed plan that has to go out for public comment. Once you consider public comment and your modifying criteria, which we'll talk more about in just a bit, you get to a ROD. And this can include interim RODs or contingency remedies. Say you have some post-ROD changes you need to make. That's where you start looking at ESDs, that explanation of significant difference, or a potential ROD amendment. And we'll talk about how to know which one you need at your site. Once you have a decision, you're looking at remedial design and remedial action. Note that adaptive management can be considered in the RIFS stage, in your RDRA stage, and during operation and maintenance of the remedies. We'll touch on that at the end of the webinar today. If you have 5-year reviews that are required at your site, those start after initiation of the selected remedial action, not at its completion, but when it starts. That's something that people have been confused about in the past. Then you get to O&M, hopefully one day site closeout and ultimately deletion from the NPL. That's where we all want to land. But for our federal facility sites, that can be a very long time from now, just given the complexity and nature of the cleanup. So I'm going to pause for a second. just to see if we have any initial questions, and we'll get ready for John to come on, introduce himself, and talk to us about removal actions.
Thanks, Emmy. At this time, I don't see any questions into the in a Q&A space, but remember the audience can keep sending them on in, and we will pause again later in just a moment for additional questions. So John, if you're able to unmute. There we go.
Hi, everyone. Can you hear me okay?
I can, and there's your video. Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks. Just give me a second here. Okay, so I'm John Burchett from the Federal Facilities Program here at EPA headquarters. Emmy and I will go through this removal action section, and Emmy, definitely jump in on some of these. And so guys, for removal actions, to the extent practical, contribute to the efficient performance in the anticipated long-term remedial action with respect of the release concern. So a lot of times we'll use these in instances where you may have a longer-term remedial action, there's an immediate threat, you need to go in and do something. So we'll go ahead and do a removal action. And then times we'll follow that up with a longer-term remedial action. And again, so oftentimes short-term actions designed to address an immediate threat to human health and the environment, and removals are executed by the lead cleanup agency. As far as timing for removal actions, there's a couple of different categories here. We do have emergency response actions. Those actions typically occur within hours, and they're required to occur within a few hours. These are times when you may not have enough time to issue an action memo before taking the action. So you find that you have an immediate threat, you need to go out and deal with it. And so those would be emergency responses. Time critical removal actions, the action time that's required on what we call them TICRAs is usually within 6 months. And typically an approved action memo is in place before initiating a non-emergency time critical response. And then the final category is non-time critical removal actions. There's typically a planning period of these for more than 6 months, and it requires an engineering evaluation cost analysis. So an ECA, as some of you mentioned in the Q&A earlier, or its equivalent before the action memo is signed. Sampling and analysis plans for removal actions. So under environmental related removal actions, EPA is responsible for reviewing and approving the SAP. So we do review and approve those. And you can see the language from the Code of Federal Regulations. If environmental samples are to be collected, the lead agency shall develop sampling and analysis plans that provide a process for obtaining data of sufficient quality and quantity to satisfy the data needs. Sampling and analysis plans shall be reviewed and approved by EPA.
Yeah, John, I'll jump in here just for a second. I have found this to be a surprise to a lot of folks who work for other federal agencies other than EPA when we point out, oh, we need to review the SAPs. There's this, well, we're the lead agency, we're doing a removal action. Why do we have to let you review the SAP? And it's important to be aware that this language doesn't say the lead agency will review it. It says shall be reviewed and approved by EPA. So as an EPA person, if you're in that role and you're not looking at the SAPs, and ultimately there tends to be a problem, that could be some sort of liability for EPA. So it's just important to be aware and to make your lead agencies aware of this requirement. It is not optional.
Thanks, Emmy. And just one thing to keep in mind is we do have the UFP QAP, the Uniform Federal Policy Quality Assurance Project Plans guidance that provides some of the framework there to develop those materials, or that they should be developed consistent with. Okay. accelerating CERCLA environmental restoration activities at federal facilities sites. So this was something that was developed and signed by EPA, DOD, and DOE 1994, and it really encourages the support of efforts at federal facility sites to accelerate and develop streamlined approaches at our sites. Emmy, anything you want to add here? And it just really identifies the use of removal actions to streamline the cleanup. And so we can utilize some of those non-time critical removal actions and interim response actions. And so this is something through 12580 really establishes a unique requirement for federal facilities and encourages the potential for cooperative decision making. Okay, removal actions guidance and non-time critical removal actions. So a couple of things to go through here. Once a federal facility is listed on the MPL, the sources of contamination should be addressed promptly. And so using removal actions or interim actions and final remedial actions are a number of different ways you can do that. When using the removal authorities, the federal facilities should really consult with EPA, the states, and the public to ensure that the action is consistent with the overall cleanup goals and strategy for the site. So as Emmy mentioned earlier, I think the puzzle pictorial was a really good way of looking at this. There's a number of different ways that you're going to have to go about cleaning up your site and removal actions, including the emergency responses and the non-time critical removal actions are a number of ways to go about doing that. And the cleanup should be consistent with the final ROD, ultimately when you delete the site from the MPL.
Yep, John, the only thing I would add here is some people might be saying, well, yeah, you need to have the regulatory agencies involved in the cleanup actions at the site. But keep in mind for removal actions, the role of regulatory oversight is very different than a remedial action in that it's not as in-depth. So a lead agency can move forward with a removal action. As we mentioned, if it's an immediate threat, it's an emergency, they're going to get out and do that with little to no documentation. If something's on fire, you need to go put out the fire, right? You can't wait to do the paperwork. But when it comes to non-time critical removal actions, it really allows more time and documents such as the ICA that can be reviewed and allow for that collaboration with the regulatory agencies and the lead agency. Ultimately, the lead agency has the authority to implement these removal actions at their sites. It's not necessarily signed off and approved by EPA or the state. They are moving forward on their own accord under their own authority typically.
Thanks, Amy. So for evaluating the non-time critical removal actions, the key question here is making sure that they'll achieve the results comparable to a removal action or to a remedial action, but be completed in less time. So selecting those non-time critical removal actions, again, as some of you mentioned, you really evaluate the alternatives in the ICA, and then the alternative must be provided to the public for a comment of a 30-day period prior to selection of the action. Okay, regulatory agencies and non-time critical removal actions. EPA and the state should have adequate participation in the development of the proposed removal action. And it's really beneficial if EPA and the states are involved in the removal planning and the decision-making process. And so really sitting down as a team, and we'll talk about partnering and some things like that. And you guys are probably familiar with those terms. Sitting down as a team and working through what are the objectives here? What are we trying to achieve? How does this fall within the bigger scope of the site cleanup? And so EPA and the state will really determine whether the removal action will be consistent with the final remedy. ARARs and non-time critical removal actions. So the ARARs, the applicable or relevant and appropriate requirement considerations, are important as part of the removal decision-making process. The NCP requires that removal actions, to the extent practical, contribute to the efficient performance of any anticipated long-term remedial actions with respect to the release concerned. And they should generally be practical to meet the ARRs in the non-time critical removal actions. If it becomes an issue, attaining the ARRs may be deferred to later in the remedial actions. Okay, next slide, we have the EPA and DOE joint memo policy from 1995, and it establishes an approach agreed upon by EPA and DOE for decommissioning surplus DOE facilities. And so the objectives here is making sure it's consistent with CERCLA, achieves the risk reduction without unnecessary delay. And the policy really establishes that the decommissioning activities will be conducted as non-time critical removal actions. And it really integrates EPA's oversight responsibility, DOE's lead agency responsibility, and the state and stakeholders' participation throughout the process. DOE and EPA recognize that removal actions will not be necessary, be the final response action needed at the facility. Anything to add there, Emmy, before we move on to rods?
No, I think that's good. Just highlighting that uniqueness at DOE sites where when those buildings have to come down, they're pretty much done through the doing an ECA and having an action memo issued to get that down to slab on grade typically. So you're not arguing about it every time or trying to recreate the real wheel with every facility that needs to come down. So that's helped streamline things.
Okay, thanks, Amy.
All right, so I think our next slide, we're going to start transitioning to talking about rods, but I wanted to check with Jean and see if we had any questions we should answer before moving on.
Yeah, we've had a few questions that came in, and I'm just going to go through them. So one of the attendees wanted to confirm the clock for a five-year review starts when the RDA work plan is finalized and not when the RA is completed. Is that true?
No, the clock starts when you commence your remedial action. So if you've completed your RDRA work plan, but you haven't actually started the action, then the clock has not started. It's unique, but we have had instances where a work plan has been finalized, but the schedule identifies a start date that is maybe several months or years in the future. So that five-year review clock won't start until you actually break ground, if that makes sense.
That's right.
Okay.
I mean, it's either, so for new actions, it's really that RA start, unless it's a federal facility site where we've had previous five-year reviews, and then it's 5 years after that previous five-year review.
Okay. And I will say John is definitely our FIFRO person who knows about these kinds of things. So take advantage if you have questions for him.
Excellent. Referring to the SAP or SAP, can you clarify the EPA's review of the SAPs that it's for sites on the NPL and it would not necessarily apply to a removal by the lead federal agency at a non-NPL site?
Yes, we are focusing on federal facility sites on the NPL, not those non-NPL sites.
Okay. And then they had a question on rods that are being prepared for federal facilities. Mm-hmm. This one is, they wanted to know if the default EPL RSLs or regional screening levels considered by EPA are ARARs or are they TBCs? And I don't know if you're going to get into that when you get into your rods.
So those RSLs, the regional screening levels, John, jump in if I miss something here. It really is a starting point in assessing the level of risk at your site. In of itself, it's not necessarily an ARAR, but it is something that's considered in your risk assessment. John, did you want to add on to that?
No, that's right, Emmy. I don't have a whole lot to add, but I think throughout the process, have discussions and close coordination with your states as well, because they may have some things that fall into those categories and work closely with your legal folks.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm thinking I'm going to take one or two quick questions here. Can you confirm, or they just want to know, in our class today, are you going to talk about interim rods and contingency rods?
Yes, we will talk about interim rods, and I'll just touch on contingency rods.
Okay. All right. There are some other questions about removal actions and states' roles and some other, I think, deeper questions. So I might hold those till later. And Emmy, I'll turn it back to you to carry on, but we will be pausing again for questions. So keep them coming in.
Perfect. All right. So let's talk about rods. First off, what is the purpose of a rod? What does it do? Number one, it certifies that remedy selection process was done accordingly, following CERCLA and the NCP. It is a summary of the technical rationale and background information related to the operable units that are in the decision. And it provides that technical information that outlines what your remedial action objectives are and what the cleanup levels are. So those are essentially the rules of the game, right? The remedial action objectives or REOs tell you, okay, this is what we're setting out to do. And the cleanup levels are, this is what we have to reach with our plan. So very, very important that those be clearly written and easily understood. And lastly, it is actually a key communication tool when speaking with the public about what's happening at the site and how you plan to move forward with cleanup. It really tells them, this is why we selected this remedy. This was the best path forward. So when it comes to looking at the different alternatives that you develop throughout your RI and FS, there are 9 criteria to evaluate the different remedial alternatives. I've heard this referred to as the 9 CERCLA criteria. I know some legal folks who don't love that term because these are 9 criteria identified in the NCP. So check with your legal folks on what language you might use in the ROD. But with these 9 criteria, you have 3 categories. Your threshold criteria, which are non-optional. You need to have a remedy that is protective of human health and the environment and that complies with ARARs or has a waiver for an ARAR. Second bucket is your primary balancing criteria. You're looking at a number of factors. How effective would this be long-term? Are you reducing toxicity, mobility, and volume of that hazardous waste? What is the short-term effectiveness? How implementable is it? And cost. Last bucket is modifying criteria. One thing I want to point out, or there's 2 things I want to point out. First one, modifying criteria cannot be fully vetted and understood until you have a proposed plan that has gone out for public comment. That's where the community acceptance comes in. You present your plan to the community in a proposed plan and they can weigh in. Perhaps public comment will say, yes, we very much support this remedy. Or it could say, what in the world do you think you're doing? This is a terrible idea. And there's all sorts of different comments that come in. So that community acceptance has to be evaluated after the community weighs in. And then you have your state acceptance. And usually, at least the states I've worked with have waited to concur on a remedy until that community public comment period is done so that they can evaluate that as well. So last, the second thing I wanted to point out about modifying criteria, primary balancing criteria and the modifying criteria are equal in consideration. The modifying criteria isn't an afterthought or something you can consider to a lesser degree. They are identified as having equal weight in the decision-making process. So very important to keep that in mind. Unfortunately, I think community acceptance, that public comment is not always given the weight it deserves. So if you're working for a regulatory agency, very important that that criteria is fully evaluated as well. All right, I'll get off my soapbox on the criteria boxes. So what should a ROD look like? Oh, and I should mention all of this information on RODs is coming from EPA's 1999 guidance on RODs. I forget the full name right now, RODs, proposed plans. There's a link to it in the related links section and in your participant manual as well. So much good information on how to write or review a ROD. First, the recommended ROD outline. Hopefully the lead agency is following this outline with the 3 parts, your declaration, which is usually short and sweet, your part 2 decision summary, which has a lot of information and is typically not short or sweet. And lastly, your responsiveness summary. And that's where you have responses to all the public comments that came in while your proposed plan was out for public comment and explains, did their comments have any change to the proposed alternative or the preferred alternative, I should say? And if so, why or why? If so, why? Or if not, why not? So that's your recommended broad outline. So that's rods right there. We're going to talk about interim actions. That rod was just really telling you what's the purpose of the document itself, how's it laid out, what criteria are used to select your alternative. But I want to focus a bit more on interim actions, and then perhaps we'll have a spot to pause for questions. So let's continue on. So how do you determine the need for an interim action? Well, ideally, when you're doing your RIFS, your early scoping for the action, that's when you might decide, well, this doesn't look like we can get to a final remedial action, but perhaps an interim remedial action is appropriate, meaning it's limited in scope. Perhaps it's only addressing certain areas, like geographic areas or media, that ultimately will be addressed by a final decision for that land or for that part of the site. Some reasons for taking an interim action include needing to, you know, get to a decision quickly or more quickly than a final ROD might take. You want to get that quick action to protect human health and the environment from a more imminent threat. And it also can help you institute temporary measures to stabilize a site or prevent further migration of contaminants or further environmental degradation. So maybe you can't get the final cleanup, not anticipating what those levels may be, but you know it makes sense to do something now. For example, it makes sense to address the source by removing it so it doesn't continue to feed the groundwater plume that is extending away from this site. So we're going to start with the source. That's the media we're looking at, that soil. However, we know groundwater still needs to be addressed, and that will be addressed in a future remedial action. So they're going to, again, connect like those puzzle pieces. But of course, if you take away the source, your plume should stop growing at the rate it was growing at before when the source was still available. Hopefully that example makes sense. So again, what is the whole role of an interim action? Well, they can be implemented for separate operable units. They can be a component of a final ROD or a step to getting to that final remedial action, depending on the scope of the interim action needed. But keep in mind, an interim action must be followed by a final ROD. And that interim action still has to be protective, and it should be addressing an exposure pathway or threat in the short term at minimum, even if you can't, again, get to those final cleanup levels that you're anticipating will be needed for the site. Another thing is when it comes to ARARs for an interim action, your decision document should only focus on ARARs related to the action being considered, not for the final remedial action or for other media or areas that aren't part of the decision. So the ARARs is very closely focused on the actions that are being proposed. So some people might say, well, if you're doing an interim action, why even bother with the final ROD? Well, it might be that your interim action takes you almost to final, and then your final ROD might be something like, oh, we're gonna continue monitoring and establish institutional controls. So in the steps of getting there, you've addressed the source, you're moving forward. That final action might be smaller in scope. It really depends on the site and what's being addressed. So what are some examples of interim actions? Well, first example, again, these are all taken from that 1999 EPA guidance. You could install an extraction well that's going to restrict migration of a groundwater plume with the intention of remediating the aquifer at a later time. So you want to get in there and keep it from moving maybe offsite or towards exposure pathways, be it homes or drinking water wells, by handling its migration. Second example, say you're providing temporary alternate source of drinking water with the intention, again, of later remediating the aquifer. But for now, there's an imminent threat, so water's being provided. Last example here is say you have some contamination in the soil, a couple of feet under the surface. You might construct a temporary cap to control or reduce exposures until that subsequent final action can be taken. So hopefully those paint a better picture for you. So what are the pros and cons of each? Pros for interim actions. They can be tailored to a limited scope of action. You can institute temporary measures for stabilization or to prevent further migration of contaminants. So ideally, it would make it easier to get to that final remedial action. And your interim action doesn't have to meet ARARs if it will become part of a total remedial action that will attain ARARs, or their waivers. So that sounded a little bit confusing, but we'll talk a bit more about that in a second. Also, it allows opportunity to gather more information to refine a final remedy. So say you're putting in wells and you're getting, you know, you're grabbing samples as those wells are going in, you're able to see what your concentrations of contaminants are. All that can help feed a decision towards a final remedy. So you're gathering data while you're out in the field while taking more immediate action. Some of the cons, you still need that final ROD, right? And that can be used as or viewed as an ineffective use of resources because getting an interim ROD issued can take as long and require as much effort as getting a final ROD issued. And, you know, some agencies prefer those final RODs are like, okay, one and done. We don't want to have to do this multiple times versus using interim RODs. And some agencies say, yeah, an interim ROD is great. Let's do what we can now, and we'll figure out the rest once we gather more information. It really depends on the culture of the lead agency that the regulatory agencies are working with that helps determine how those conversations go. And last thing, an interim action limits property transfer. So in order for the federal government to transfer property, all remedial actions required at that site need to be implemented. So if you have an interim action, that means you don't have a final remedial action, which means that land can't be transferred over to another group for some sort of beneficial reuse. And that can definitely be a con. Okay, let's go to the next slide here. Just summarizing the views on interim actions. There's differing views. It's going to vary from lead agency to lead agency and how they're used as part of the cleanup framework. EPA definitely supports the use of interim RODs. DOE, Department of Energy, has expressed support for the use of interim RODs, and they are used across the DOE complex. And we've seen that at Department of Defense sites, there's generally less support for the interim RODs and a preference for final RODs. So that's not to argue, that's just information for you so you can help anticipate what kind of conversations you might have at your federal facility sites. Okay, so I said I was going to talk a little bit more about waivers. So an interim action ARAR waiver is one of the six waivers that are available. So it can be used when an ARAR cannot be met as part of the interim remedy, but you know it will be met as part of the final site remedy. So that interim action is not designed or expected to be final, but the selected remedy still represents that best balance of trade-offs among the different alternatives based on those 9 criteria identified in the NCP. Remember the 3 buckets that we talked about. And although the preference for treatment that EPA has in selecting remedies will be addressed in the final decision, those treatment components should still support that preference. You still want to try and reduce toxicity, mass or volume, excuse me, of the contamination. But if you're going forward with an interim action and you know, we have a quick example here, that can be a great step in getting to your final cleanup. So in this example here, we're looking at the Hanford site, and this was an interim groundwater remedy. So you can see in the colorful plumes, we have different contaminants across the site. And this is in South Central Washington at our Hanford site. So you're like, where did all these plumes come from? Well, in the 40s and 50s, we were in the middle of the Manhattan Project producing plutonium for the Cold War. And that resulted in a lot of soil and groundwater contamination. So the Hanford site is on the NPL, and we know it's going to be a very long and complex cleanup. So when we were looking at the situation we had here, the thought was, well, how can we start to address this contamination? Let's come to the next slide. Oh, I got ahead of myself, sorry. So to address all of those plumes that we were seeing, we couldn't tackle it all at once. So there was an interim action issued, and it was intended to stabilize and reduce the contaminant mass in those higher concentration areas of the plume through some groundwater extraction and treatment. So the plan we knew right away wasn't to address every single plume, all the groundwater, like not all of it could be targeted at first. So we're looking at a specific geographic area to reduce that contaminant mass. And this is where the ARAR waiver came in. So this is a potential source of drinking water. So we know maximum contaminant levels, or MCLs, are going to apply under our drinking water standards. So with the interim action, it was decided, well, can we get to 10 times the drinking water standard for uranium and technetium 99 to help reduce the contaminant mass? But we know we're going to need a final action to ultimately get to those MCLs. And it was a good use of an interim action because it's supporting the long-term remediation plans to restore the aquifer with a first step in reducing the concentration that helps with migration and helps get a step up on the remedial actions necessary there. So ultimately, that pump and treat system ran from 1997 and was ended in 2011 as a final remedial action was being studied and pursued for the operable unit. And it ended up doing really well in reducing the contaminant mass of uranium and technetium 99. And on the side, also was removing carbon tetrachloride and nitrate from the aquifer that were also treated. So that's just one example of how interim action can be used. I'm gonna ask John to come on here just to talk about the completion of interim actions, because we've had some confusion between this 2006 guidance that was issued and then EPA's 2011 guidance on closeout procedures for NPL sites. So John, I'll let you start explaining this to the group.
Okay, sounds good, Emmy. And that is the key takeaway here, guys, is the 2011 closeout procedures for NPL sites does supersede that 2006 guidance. I think the key difference to point out here is the 2006 guidance relied on the use of the interim RACR to document the RA completion and groundwater and surface water restoration actions. And we'll look at a graphic in the next slide, but we are no longer doing what we're calling IRACR. So it eliminates the distinction between interim and final RA completions. The IRACR is no longer used to document the attainment of cleanup goals. And the data demonstrating the cleanup completion goes in your FCOR document instead, or your site closeout document. And I guess one of the questions I typically get on this is, okay, well, we attain the cleanup goals, but our FCOR or PCOR isn't for the next 30, 40 years. And so the advice I always give back to folks in these cases is I do recommend at that time, because a lot of turnover can occur in, over the course of 30 years or so, do some sort of technical memorandum where you and the team document the attainment of those cleanup goals. And then that gives you something you can refer back to years later when you actually get to the PCOR or FCOR. The next slide. So this is just really a pipeline graphic. We sort of just talked, this is basically a graphic of what we just talked through. And so when your remedy is constructed and you're confident that the system is really operating as you intended, that's when you're gonna do the RACR for these groundwater and surface water restoration pipeline activities. And so there might be some instances where you have a longer term remedy. And so this doesn't just apply to the groundwater remedies, but also for maybe multiple components to a remedy, like a soils remedy in combination with a groundwater remedy. The 2011 guidance does give you the flexibility to do multiple RA completions on a single operable unit. So really think about your timing. You know, if there's gonna be a few year delay, I think we see this sometimes at DOE sites, if there's building destruction or something like that, there might be a long delay between the actions. It might give you an opportunity to take advantage of documenting some of that incremental progress that's being made.
Awesome, thank you so much, John. I think this is a good place to pause and see if there's any questions.
Okay, so Emmy, we have had a few questions come in. Multiple people have asked if you could explain the difference between an interim action and a removal action.
I'm sorry, the difference between an interim action and a removal action?
Yes.
So remember, if you have an interim action going through as an interim record of decision, one big difference is the level of regulatory oversight. In a remedial process, you have full regulatory involvement in reviewing those decision documents. For removal actions, which might be similar, right? A non-time critical removal action might look similar to an interim action. In those, there is more of the lead agency moving forward with their authority under Executive Order 12580. And while it's highly recommended that collaboration happen between the lead agency and the regulatory agencies, as well as the public, it's not as big a piece of the pie, I guess is the easiest way I would explain that. John, did you want to elaborate?
No, I think that's good, Emmy. Yeah, I think that's a good explanation.
Okay. We also asked if you can confirm if the 9 criteria are applicable to both removal and remedial actions.
So the 9 criteria and the NCP are specific to our remedial actions and identifying, you know, how you're going to identify the best remedy to move forward with. Removal actions are really looking at, what is it, scope, cost. Oh, I'm forgetting the third category for removal actions just because we're a little less involved in those. But no, it's for remedial actions that we use the 9 criteria.
Yeah, and I think one of the key takeaways here is really as you're doing interim actions or as you're doing removal actions, really think about how that, think back to our sort of puzzle pieces, think about how that falls within the larger scale remedial action or the cleanup for the entire site that's going to take place down the line.
Okay. We did have a question that came in. What if DOD is intending to complete the removal action with the intent that that is the final remedial action, but then it moves it through the TCRA process and documents? Can you comment on that situation?
Let me see if I understand. It's a scenario where the lead agency is doing a removal action, but they're anticipating that no additional action will be required to address contamination at the site. That gets risky because what's the final vision for the site? Are the regulatory agencies and the lead agency on the same page? Are we cleaning up to residential standards or industrial standards? If there's a disagreement there and that removal action does not, in fact, contribute to the final remedial action anticipated for the site, then that's going to be an issue. If we're all on the same page and the removal action was to dig and haul contaminated soil away, then that's probably not going to prohibit any type of future action that might be anticipated for the site.
The other thing I'll add to that is really think about the public comment that needs to occur during the remedial selection process. And so you don't want to bypass that opportunity for public comment. I think also a lot of times when we're doing these removal actions, there's a follow-up with the longer term land use controls and things like that. And so those aren't things that you can be implementing through removal actions.
Okay. There are a lot of questions that are starting to come in. I'll take just a couple of more here. There was a quick question asking if you can clarify on slide 28 regarding the interim actions and limits to property transfer. Can you point where these limits are outlined and if that's a hard rule?
Yes. So if you look at section 120, it's section 120H, and that specifically talks about property transfers, and it specifically says that all remedial actions for a site need to be completed before that transfer can occur. I believe if it's a final remedial action that's been implemented at a site and you're in that O&M phase, I believe transfer can happen, but it has to be O&M for a final decision, not an interim one.
Okay.
So yes, section 120H has more on that. of CERCLA.
Okay. Okay. And then can you write a FCOR or FCOR if your RAOs have not been met yet? So for example, groundwater will not be cleaned up for decades.
John, I was looking at you. I believe the answer is no, that you have
I think that would be a case where you would do a PCOR. And then once those RAOs are achieved, you would follow that up with the FCOR.
Okay. Okay, I think perhaps just in the interest of time, we're at 2 p.m. Eastern, so we've got about 1 hour left. I think we'll carry on with the presentation at this point, but we will pause again for questions so you guys can keep sending those into the Q&A.
Okay, Emmy, so I think I might have, do I have control back? Changing the remedy post-rod, so there are a couple of different options here, guys, and we'll start walking through these. Okay, so the lead agency or EPA's determination of whether the post-rod change to the selected action or remedial action is minor, significant, or fundamental is really driven by these three categories that you see on the screen, these three primary factors. So it's the scope. Does the remedy change alter the scope of the remedy? Performance, would the change alter the performance of the remedy? And cost, are there significant changes in the cost from the cost that were estimated in the original ROD? And so changes of the remedy post-ROD, we have the post-ROD changes are documented by the following. The very minor changes, we do those through what we call a memo to the file or a note to the file. And these are really insignificant or minor changes. And these are going from these, the first bullet to the last bullet, these are going in levels of significance from the least sort of public comment or involvement to the most. And so the second of which is the explanation of significant difference or the ESD. And we do those for significant changes. And then finally a ROD amendment. And we would do that where there is a fundamental change to the remedy that was originally selected in the ROD. And so the changes significantly affecting the remedy and selected in the ROD will need more explanation and opportunity for public comment. And that's, again, as you go, as you progress through these, your ESDs, your ROD amendments, those require sort of more documentation of what's going on there and different levels of public involvement. I think we'll talk about those more in detail in the following slides. Okay, so the type of changes here, this looks like it's a question for you, Jean, that we're going to send out to the group.
That is correct. So I am launching a poll on the screen now, which is an apply your understanding opportunity. So there are three types of changes. They show up as three separate poll questions. A for significant change, 2B is fundamental change, and then 3C is minor change. Underneath each one of those types of changes, you have the option to select which type of document you would use based on that type of a change. So you can either pick memo to file, explanation of significant differences, or ROD amendment. So you should be selecting each type, each document only once. So you'll correspond a document to a type of change. And then once you've clicked the circle under each type of change for what you think the appropriate document would be, you'll scroll down and you can hit the submit button. Looks like about half of you have participated in sending in your answers, and this only gets more fun the more of you who participate in these interactive polls. This also helps our instructors know that they have been successful in sharing some information with you. So remember, there's no penalty if you get it wrong. So if you don't know, I would do your very best guess, and then we'll talk through those correct answers. If you are unable to access those pop-up polls, if you're on a mobile device for any reason, you may see a pop-up on the screen or may find the poll under the three dots or more menu in the mobile version of Zoom. And so with that, John, I have done my very best to buy some time here as we're collecting those results. And I'm going to go ahead and lock the poll down here. So I'm going to close it. And let's take a look at those results with about 3/4 of the audience having participated in their response. I'm going to say for a significant change, most people picked an explanation of significant differences. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. And the key way to remember it, guys, significant and significant sort of align with one another. So if you're doing a significant change, the explanation of significant difference, or ESD. That's the correct answer.
For the fundamental change, most people selected a ROD amendment. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
All right. And then for that last one, minor change, most of the audience selected memo to file.
Yep, that's right. Excellent right. job there, guys.
All right, carry on, John.
Okay. Okay, so now we're going to talk a little bit more about explanation of significant differences. And so this is something where the change significantly affects the remedy. And again, these are issued through the ESD. And so the ESD must describe to the public why the significant change is needed and sort of the nature of that change, and also summarize the information that led to making the changes. And the third one is here, it must affirm that the revised remedy complies with the NCP and the statutory requirements of CERCLA. So generally, a new non-criteria analysis is not required for an ESD. One of the things I think is very helpful is doing this side-by-side comparison of what was originally selected in your ROD and sort of what's changing through the ESD, and clearly displaying the changes that are significant through that process. It must be made available to the public by publishing a notice of availability and a brief description of the ESD in a major or local newspaper or a major local newspaper, and then placing it in the administrative record file in the information repository for the site. And so for federal facility sites, those are maintained by the other federal agency.
John, I just wanted to chat a bit on that slide. Yeah. You'll note we had two apples. So I want people to think about that as you're comparing apples to apples. Very similar, slight differences. You're going to summarize that in your ESD, but it's not a whole fundamental change. It's some changes, significant, but not fundamental.
That's right, Emmy. Yeah, that's good. ESD examples. So, and guys, the other thing I'll add here is all of this is really spelled out very well in the ROD guidance. I think specific to ESDs, it's section 7.3.2. And so if you're asking yourself the question, okay, well, what category does this fall into? I think for referring back to that 99 ROD guidance and going through some of the examples they provide is a very good place to start. And so some of these ESD examples we have here is a large increase in the volume and or cost increase. And then introduction of a secondary technology. Emmy, anything you want to add to these examples?
Oh, sorry, I lost my mute button there for a second. No, I think, again, it's a slight change, but ultimately you're moving forward with your initial selected remedy.
Okay, ROD amendments, Emmy, I think this goes over to you.
Yes. All right, let's go ahead and switch gears a bit. Again, we were talking apples to apples before, but now we're going to switch it up a bit. Here we go. So with ROD amendments, that is when you have a fundamental change. It's changing the selected remedy with respect to those questions that we told you to initially consider, right? Are there major changes to scope, to performance, or to cost? So when you have a major fundamental change, you have to have that portion of the ROD that's being amended undergo a new nine criteria analysis, which also includes an ARARS analysis. So you may have heard people phrase this as, oh, the ROD froze the ARARS. We don't want to open the ROD with a ROD amendment because then we have to look at the ARARS again. You unfreeze the ARARS. So if you've heard that terminology, that's what it's referring to. Your ROD amendment is going to require
that AVARS analysis. So now, instead of having apples to apples, you've gone from apples to oranges. One thing is not like the other. There is a fundamental difference between the two. And in your ROD amendment, you're explaining what that is. So let's look at this a little more closely. So with ROD amendments, those remedial design and remedial action activities that are being conducted on other portions of the site or the operable units that are not proposed for changes may continue during the amendment process because they're essentially the same plan. There's no changes there. But for a ROD amendment, it's almost like issuing a new ROD or a ROD, excuse me. The lead agency has to conduct that required public participation. So you have a proposed plan that's going to go out for a minimum of 30 days public comment, and you need to offer the opportunity for the public to request a meeting if they so desire. There is sufficient interest in this to go out for that public meeting. So again, it's a heavy lift. It's not just a memo to file. It is a larger effort. And again, it's similar to that ROD process you went through the first time. Let's talk about some examples for ROD amendments. Maybe this will help. So say you have a change in a primary treatment method. So with the ESD examples that we just talked about, it was a secondary method, right? So if the primary treatment method is changed for here in this example, it says, say your initial remedy was to use in situ soil washing. And it turns out during your testing and remedial design, that's just not going to work. It's not going to happen at this site. So then a decision is made to fundamentally change the remedy to excavation and thermal treatment of the waste. Those two things are very different. They're fundamentally different. A ROD amendment would need to be done in order to change that remedy. And it's not done after the fact, right? You're going out with this proposed plan before the action takes place, just like you would with a ROD. Second example, remedy change from containment to treatment with a cost increase. So say during a five-year review, you have this smaller site and tests indicate that the containment remedy you implemented years ago is not protective. And now you need a more active response approach. Essentially, containment's not working, so you're gonna have to treat it. A new remedy must be selected that will meet protectiveness requirements, and that's going to mean additional cost for the site. That would require a ROD amendment. All right, so we're going to apply your understanding and Jean will take us through this little quiz or question for you all.
Okay, so I'm gonna pop up a poll here in just 1 second, but I want to be sure to read that first sentence before I pop the poll up. So in this opportunity, we're asking you to consider that there are three types of post record of decision or ROD documentation that exist. We're going to ask which one of these is a fundamental change in the ROD and requires a ROD amendment. So I'm going to pop open that poll and you simply select the circle next to the answer that you think one of these documents is a fundamental change in the ROD and requires a ROD amendment. And then be sure to hit that submit button after you have cast your vote. And Emmy, I'm looking at about 15% of the audience. Now we're up to about a quarter of them have voted. So remember, we can't tell who's voting how. So this is really just to confirm that you have been able to capture some knowledge from our fabulous presenters. It helps them refine their instructional technique as well. So even if you're not sure, take your best guess and we'll talk about that right answer here in just a moment. And remember, you can only pick one answer in this particular question. If you're having any problems with that poll window, feel free to type the answer into the Q&A if that's easier for you, and I'll make a note of it there. And there we go, Emmy. I think we've got about 3/4 of the audience having voted, so I'm going to go ahead and hit my end button. And per the results that I've collected, it looks like about 2/3 of the audience picked option B, the selected remedy is not removing a contaminant efficiently enough, and the lead agency has decided to pursue an alternative remedy. Is that correct?
That is correct. That item B is a fundamental change, while items A and C are significant, but not fundamental.
Excellent.
Good job, everybody. And you know, sometimes getting it wrong makes it stick better than when you get it right. So if you put in A or C, hey, that's okay. And I would say it's a gray space, right, between an ESD and a ROD amendment. Perhaps you could make an argument that an ESD is appropriate, and others might think, no, this is actually a fundamental change. So working in partnership with your regulatory agencies and the lead agency is so important, because really nothing is black and white. There's a few things like NCP requirements. I would say those are black or white, but is it an ESD or is it a significant change or a fundamental change? I could see instances where you could argue for either. So it's not always cut and dry. Just keep that in mind. All right, let's continue on. Ooh, we're gonna touch on adaptive management. So in 2018, EPA issued a memo regarding broadening the use of adaptive management at our sites or at NPL sites. So it really looks at that continuous re-evaluation and management prioritization at your site. You know there's uncertainty that is related to the nature and extent of contamination, especially with our very large, very complex sites. Sometimes you find contamination you weren't expecting to find, or what you think was a small problem ends up to be a much larger problem or challenge than what you originally expected. So by using adaptive management to have a structured and continuous planning, implementation, and assessment process, that helps allow the team to adapt to what they're finding in the field. And ultimately, you're trying to reduce those site uncertainties so you can be more confident in the decisions that are being made. So adaptive management, it's kind of one of those terms people just throw around, but perhaps we don't have a clear understanding of what it is. So I wanted to highlight some very, you know, specific points in the CERCLA process where you could be considering adaptive management. So for example, here early in the RFS process, you can help ensure stakeholder input and consensus by discussing high-level site strategies. Like maybe you don't have all the details hammered out, but at a high level, you can engage in those conversations with all of your stakeholders, your lead agency, regulatory agencies, and that will help identify if you're going to have that community support and regulatory support for the plan later on down the road. So early in their scoping process, if you're already in that RIFS stage, you can use adaptive management to ensure that the site resources that are being used out in the field are really addressing the key site uncertainties. Sometimes data for the sake of data is not helpful. You want to make sure that your data is of sufficient quality and quantity to address the specific questions for the site. One way we do that is with real-time measurements. Instead of having to have multiple rounds of sampling, you know, multiple rounds of mobilization for sampling, if you can get real-time data that helps determine, oh, we should sample deeper here, or we, you know, this area is coming up clean, let's go to the next location, that can really help you get the data you need to make the best decision possible. During the RDRA stage, when you're doing that, say you're doing some pilot test during design or doing further site characterization beyond your RIFS or treatability studies even, you can scope this specifically to address the uncertainties that were identified through your ROD and RIFS. And lastly, say you're past all that. You're a new RPM and you just inherited a site that had a ROD signed in 1998 and you are an O&M, but say O&M is kind of stuck as far as remedy operations go. Maybe you've had a pump and treat running for years with diminishing returns on running that system, or you know some in-situ treatment isn't working as effectively as you thought, and there's still an unacceptable risk there. Well, by looking at adaptive management, you can see, well, is there a way to tweak the remedy to help it be more effective so we can get to completion sooner? So again, just being flexible throughout the process, still within the requirements and regulations, there is a lot of flexibility that can be found. And it's usually better or more easily found when all the involved parties are working together. So that's my spiel on adaptive management, just touching on it quickly. But I want you all to tell me when you think adaptive management could be used on these examples.
All right, so I'm about to launch another poll, but in this case, you get to select all that would apply. So you don't have to pick just one. You can pick one or all, if or whatever combination. So we're looking for which of the examples below on the pop-up poll would benefit from an adaptive management approach. So is it A, that pump and treat groundwater remedy, which has been operating for 10 years, and the contaminant levels are not decreasing at the anticipated rate? Is it B, a site in the RIFS phase and it's preparing for sampling activities? There's a high level of uncertainty with where the contamination is located. Is it C, multiple stakeholders have a high level of interest in a site that is in scoping its RIFS activities and it's anticipated that the public will want to be heavily involved through the CERCLA process there? Or is it D, an early action to remove barrels filled with hazardous substance is needed at a site? I'm looking at about a quarter of the audience, or now we're up to about a third, have sent their responses in. So you can just check the box next to any answer that you think would benefit from an adaptive management approach. And then again, hit that submit button at the bottom when you are done selecting your choices. I do understand that that might be a lot to read for some of you. So again, if it's just easier, you can type it into the Q&A. But Emmy, as I'm looking at it, we're looking at about two thirds. I'm going to give everyone just a second or so longer here to cast their votes. And remember, gentle reminder for those of you on mobile devices, sometimes the polls get hidden under that three dots or more menu. Then you can pop it open in a full screen on your mobile device to respond. And so, Emmy, I think we may have capped out at the total responses that we're going to receive. So I'm going to end it and let's take a look at the results. So it looks like A, the pump and treat site was a clear winner with about 85% of the audience picking that. B got about 72% that came in second place. And then C got about half of the audience's vote. So A, B, and C were the top three answers, but still about a quarter of them picked D. What would you say the right answers are?
So I would say adaptive management could be used in scenarios A, B, and C. D, that action to remove barrels filled with hazardous substances could probably be addressed through an early action or a removal action just to get dig them out and dispose of them appropriately. But the other three, there's opportunities for looking at adaptive management there. Okay. Let's go ahead. Before we get into five-year reviews, should we stop for questions, Jean?
I think that would be a great idea. We did have a question that just came in on the adaptive management policy that one of the attendees noted was supposed to be published in December of 2019. And so they were just wondering if EPA has any guidance or procedures on adaptive management that might be released soon.
So I do not know of a date when this guidance might be coming out. As you all may know, we've had a change in administration. And so this perhaps is not as much in the forefront as it was in the 2018-2019 timeframe. But we are still supportive EPA of the use of adaptive management, but not sure when that guidance is coming, to be honest.
Okay. One of the attendees asked, if there is a change in the ARARs from the last five-year review, would this be considered an ESD?
So I think when you're saying if there is a change in the ARARs, it would, I'm not sure if you mean like a cleanup level or toxicity levels or something like that, that would come fall into new information that should be considered. If that change impacts protectiveness, then you might have to do an additional action to address protectiveness. And if that's a fundamental change, you'd be looking at a ROD amendment. If you're just updating that portion of the decision document, but it's not really calling for any additional changes, then an ESD could be used in that case, if there's no questions about protectiveness there.
Okay. And then earlier on, a few of the attendees had asked if you could give some specific examples of significant versus fundamental changes in a remedy.
So we talked about a few of them, like one significant change is when the secondary treatment is being implemented. So say you have a pump and treat remedy, and there's a secondary treatment that's using a particular type of resin. And then it turns out, oh, this resin doesn't work well. We're going to use this GAC instead. Then that would be a change in secondary mission. And excuse me, a change in the secondary treatment, which would be a significant change you could identify through an ESD. But if you're going from pump and treat to in situ stabilization, whoa, that's fundamentally different. So two very different examples. John, did you have other examples?
Yeah, others I would say, you know, if you went to a more passive remedy originally, like MNA, and then you found that you're not getting sort of the response that you expected, and so now you're going to go ahead and do a pump and treat system or something like that, that would be an instance of a ROD amendment. So there's a couple of things that fall into categories like that. The other thing, Emmy, that I'll add, I don't know if you want to talk about this or not, it's sort of in the gray area. I think sometimes we do an ESD, but we'll also allow the opportunity for public comment on those, and we'll send it out for public comment. So that's also an option as well. But again, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, that's great to point out. When issuing an ESD, it is not a requirement in the NCP that it be issued for public comment before the action is taken. But if you anticipate that significant change, while not fundamental, is still going to be very controversial, then it might make sense to have a public comment period, have that discussion before issuing an ESD.
Okay. Somebody just asked that they believe that someone mentioned that a public meeting should be held if it's requested during the ROD amendment process. And they were just wondering if you could elaborate on it, that public meetings are required. And so the usage of the term should be, I think, is what's throwing them off, because I think they thought you had to do a public meeting.
That is a common assumption when it comes to the CERCLA process. So the NCP states that the lead agency has to offer the opportunity for a public meeting. So the opportunity for a public meeting is not the same as assuming a public meeting has to be held. I will say, though, EPA did that for a long time. Like, oh, we're issuing a proposed plan, public meeting, we're going to do it. That was the custom, but the requirement is that you offer that opportunity. So you may issue a proposed plan, and in your community involvement section, it says, if you would like to request a public meeting on this topic, please contact so-and-so by X date. However, if you know this is a controversial decision that's going to get a lot of public attention, it would be safe to assume that public meeting is going to be needed, and you might want to start planning it before the proposed plan is issued. You have to use your best judgment in that case. But yeah, the public meeting is not a requirement as identified in the NCP.
Okay, so do you need a public meeting for an ESD?
No, you do not need a public meeting for an ESD.
Okay.
Remember, in an ESD, the action might be already, it's over and done with. The significant change has happened. You're just issuing this ESD to document the change and to let the public know the change occurred.
Okay. And then a couple of people were asking questions about adaptive management and mm-hmm. the ROD process. And so for some people, this is new. Some people are just wondering how it plays a role in the ROD process. They're just wondering, is adaptive management something that is separate and has to be agreed upon by the lead agency and the regulators, or how exactly does it fit in?
So if you're working with your team and you're saying, well, we want to be flexible, we want to consider adaptive management in this remedy, it can be something that you're actually already doing and not calling adaptive management. For example, if you're implementing a pump and treat remedy and you have an idea of where the wells should go, how many wells you should have, you can put that into your remedy. It might say, oh, we're going to need 28 wells in these locations. But if you instead identify a phased approach, we're going to install wells five at a time and then determine additional locations and additional well needs based on the information gathered, you're flexible. It hasn't been laid out in stone how you're going to set up this system, and you are being flexible with the data that's being collected. I think a lot of remedies probably do something like that through phased approaches, where you can gear the next phase based on the data you collected in that previous one. John, do you want to add on?
Only a couple of things I'll add here is it's really just a comprehensive plan with sort of some interim milestones along the way in achieving your overall site cleanup objective. So, you know, laying out milestones along the way, checking off some boxes, I think that's helpful in the overall site cleanup approach, because there's times where you're looking 10 years ahead and that can be sort of overwhelming in trying to get a site totally cleaned up.
Okay. One other example I'll offer is I had a site when I was working as a remedial project manager that pump and treat had been going on under an interim action. A final remedial action was issued to continue and achieve cleanup levels with that final groundwater rod. And after years of pumping, realized, oh, this is going well, but not as well as we thought. So the group worked together, EPA, the lead agency, and the state discussed, well, can we look at an optimization plan to help improve the remedy as selected and give us some flexibility in how we move forward? And doing that optimization study during O&M is another example of using adaptive management.
Okay. I think we'll take one more question here. Somebody chimed in and asked if a contingency rod is the same thing as adaptive management.
Sorry. Yes. So we actually did not have a slide dedicated to contingency rods. And honestly, they're not really used that much. Some of our older rods had contingency aspects to them. But now I think, you know, you hear contingency rod and people are like, oh, no, let's not do that. Because it's like, okay, we're going to do A. If A doesn't work out, we're going to do B. So, I mean, technically it is an option. It's a valid option. The only thing is, when you have a contingency rod written in, you have to have a clear trigger of when you're going to move from option A to option B, clearly identified in detail. And if you do that, and it's very clear to understand, you can simply issue an ESD to say we went from option A to option B and we, you know, implemented our contingency plan. If your rod identifies a contingency that is not clear and the trigger is not identified, then you're probably going to need a rod amendment to implement a contingency plan. So it gets sticky. That's why a lot of agencies just step back and say, no, thanks. We don't want to do that.
Okay. I mean, I think at this time, perhaps we'll carry on with the presentation. And then again, we'll take another question break here in a moment, but the audience can keep sending those questions in.
Perfect. So we're at our last topic, and that's looking at five-year reviews and impacts on remedies. So with a five-year review, I just want to plug that last month we had our federal facility five-year review training, which is archived if you'd like to check that out. But anyways, getting back to five-year reviews. So under Executive Order 12580, that lead agency is responsible for ensuring that five-year reviews are being conducted at sites where they are required or appropriate. So a statutory review or just in a review that's appropriate to do for that site. For federal facility sites, the lead agency is going to conduct the five-year review. EPA guidance suggests that you start on this effort at least 18 months before the due date of the five-year review, because it is a long process. And it does also require letting the public know that EPA guidance highly suggests that you let the public know that as a lead agency, you're starting this five-year review process. So the lead agency is gonna get the information, write up these five-year reviews for all the site or operable units at a site that have a record of decision in place. And then that document is submitted to EPA for review and comment. And from there, EPA, like typically the lead agency will provide a draft to the regulatory agencies and they can review and provide comment. And those comments can be you know, affect change in the language so you get a document that's mostly agreed upon by all the involved parties. But if, say, the lead agency issues a five-year review and it's final, here you go, EPA, here's our five-year review. And then upon reading it, the EPA RPM is like, we do not concur with these determinations that you've made. We don't think this remedy is protective, or you categorize this incorrectly. In that situation, EPA can say, we don't agree with the determinations you made, so we're going to issue a letter which will identify our independent findings. And you might ask, well, why does that matter? Keep in mind that that is reported to Congress if there's independent findings issued. So some agencies don't want to, you know, have that bad mark on their report card, so to speak. But again, the lead agency is responsible for ensuring not only that the five-year review is completed, that the document is issued, but also that any recommendations identified in the five-year review or follow-up actions are in fact completed. So very quickly, here are the different determinations that can be made for decisions that are in place. So you're looking back, you have, you're considering if there's any new information that's come to light. Has there been a change in cleanup levels, toxicity levels? Is there any other new information that's happened? Are there any new exposure pathways to be considered? So all of that goes into your five-year review. And then you can determine if it's protective or it will be protective. Say you're in construction and you're assuming once the remedy is completed, it will be protective. Maybe it's protective in the short term, but long term, you don't think that cap's going to last. It has to be looked at, or it's just not protective. That big X, you know, action required here soon. Or it might be, you know, we don't have enough information right now, so we're going to defer protectiveness until we have more information. So when is a remedy not considered protective? Here are a couple of examples. If there's an immediate threat present, an exposure pathway that could result in unacceptable risks, like a drinking water well that has contaminated water traveling towards it or already present. Perhaps migration of contaminants is uncontrolled and it's posing an acceptable risk to human health and the environment. Is there seepage from a groundwater plume to surface water that then is going downstream to a public park, is an example. Are there any potential or actual exposure that is clearly present or evidence of exposure? For we get this, like this is a very sticky situation, but say there's a site that was a munitions response site and there's probably still buried explosive material there and you have people trespassing. Like, whoa, that is a very real problem that we're all still trying to figure out how to best address. But in that case, would you say there's a potential or actual exposure present? And say, yeah, the institutional controls aren't working and there are potential exposures that could happen with severe consequences. And last, if the remedy cannot meet a new cleanup level and it's now determined that that previous cleanup level is outside of the risk range, so it's presenting an unacceptable risk. You have to see what recommendations are needed, if there's additional studies needed to determine if action is required. So what if there are recommendations identified or a remedy is, you know, short-term protectiveness is there, but long-term, we're not sure. So you're going to have these follow-up actions in the five-year review. If the remedy is not protective based on the five-year review, then clearly you should have recommendations to address protectiveness. It might not be, oh, you need to go and change the remedy to X, but it could say, oh, this potential exposure pathway needs to be studied and if necessary, action should be taken. Language like that, it varies from site to site, the kind of language that you'll use. But keep in mind, that recommendation in the five-year review is not equal to a remedy selected in a ROD. It is the start. It's the identification. You're raising the flag like, oh, I think we have a problem over here. If that five-year review determines a remedy is not performing as designed or changes are needed to the selected remedy, then you likely will have to follow up with an ESD or a ROD amendment, depending how big the change is. So sometimes I know there's confusion where people say, oh, well, this recommendation in the five-year review, it really doesn't have the teeth of a decision document. It's just raising the flag that, hey, there's a problem over here. We should do something about it. So one more poll to see if this stuck with you all.
All right. So again, in this time, I'm going to give everyone a moment or two to read through this particular slide before popping up that floating poll window where you'll simply select true or false. So in this case, we're evaluating a statement given the scenario on the slide and wondering if the remedy is still protective. So here, Site A is preparing for its second five-year review. The ROD was issued in 2005. However, the cleanup level for the primary contaminant of concern became more stringent in 2012. And then based on that new cleanup level, the existing COC concentration exceeds the cleanup level. Because the remedy is still performing as designed and the RAOs were met and therefore the institutional controls are no longer in place, the other federal agency concludes that the remedy is still protective. So with that background, I will launch the poll window and you now have the option to select true or false. Is the remedy still protective? So simply click the circle next to the answer and then hit submit. About a third of the audience has voted. And I'll give you all just a few more moments. Remember, this is your last opportunity to shine and show Emmy and John what a great job you have done paying attention and learning. If you're having any technical difficulties with these online pop-up polls, remember that Q&A space is available. You can always send your written response in there. Got about two-thirds of you having voted. Hopefully a handful of you will go ahead and take the leap and participate. If you've clicked over to something else, come on back. Just click back and give us a quick answer for this last one. And we will be closing out here in a few moments. All right, Emmy, I think I'm going to go ahead and lock this poll down and let's talk about the results. So about 80% of the audience picked false, but about a quarter said true. What do you think the answer is?
So if you picked false, I would agree with you. It would show that this remedy can't meet the new cleanup level, especially if that previous cleanup level is outside of the risk range, right? Then it's likely not protective. But in the five-year review, you could write something like, we recommend that the new cleanup level based on the standard should be adopted, and if necessary, that the remedy be modified. Perhaps with your exposure pathways, you would end up being okay. But just the fact that you have a more stringent cleanup level now, I would say that it's false. But again, it's not a perfect scenario. And in real life, also not perfect scenarios that we come up against. And there is some gray there. So I could understand if someone voted true on this case. Especially like say you had contaminated soil at depth that's not posing a risk to groundwater and meets your state standards for clean backfill to the surface. If the cleanup level changed, but there's not an exposure pathway, you might say, oh, it's fine, it's still protective. So that would be an example of when you could say it's still protective. I'm done. I'm done with my examples.
Excellent. All right, Emmy, carry on.
Okay. Let's go ahead and get ready to close us out. It looks like we will have time to address a few more questions. I hope that you learned more about all the different types of decision documents that can be used at a federal facility site and some of the nuances on the different type of sites that we deal with, and also how to make those post-ROD changes. I will let you read the course summary for yourselves, but Jean, are there any other last questions we should try to address today?
Oh, Emmy, there are questions that I think we should try to address today in the time that we do have remaining. So I see, John, you're coming back on camera, and I'll go ahead and add you to the spotlight there. And I will remind the audience, we do have a few moments left here in class. So if you had a question, now is a great time to put that into the Q&A. I'm going to start reading through some of those questions, and we will try to get through as many as we can in the time that we have left behind. I will just give you a cautionary note to some of the participants who are putting in some very site-specific scenarios. We may not have the time to address those particular types of questions, but remember, our instructors, their contact information is listed on the seminar homepage. Emmy's going to talk about points of contact in FIFRO, and I know that they are always always available to talk with people one-on-one as well if you have very site-specific questions. So rather than having you type up a paragraph about that, I'll just give you all that cautionary note that we might not be able to take those site-specific questions. And let me jump right on in. So this first question asks, would adding sites to a ROD require a, and I may pronounce the acronym wrong, ROTA, ROD A?
So if you are adding sites to a ROD, my initial question is, in your RIFS, were those sites considered? I'm assuming they were not because you're adding them. So that is a different scope. And then to me, that would be a fundamental difference. Perhaps you want to implement a similar remedy, but your understanding of the extent of contamination and its nature is not identified in the decision document. So I would say you need a ROD amendment where you provide that information and then identify that selected remedy. John, is that sound right?
I would agree as well. Yeah, I think there's definitely some questions there. Although the remedy that you're ultimately selecting might be the same, you know, we go back to talking about sort of that scope and costs and all of those things are going to be altered by pulling a new site into that decision document. So yeah, ROD amendment.
One thing I've seen at some sites is a plug and play approach. So you say any sites that meet this criteria will be addressed through this selected remedy. And so any site, so say you have a very large site, but the contamination is very similar across a geographic area. You're doing, you know, you start in one section, but you want to be able to do the same thing in other sections. We don't see these ROTAs a lot, and you could see why. There's a lot of questions. Is the criteria being followed specifically? Is this an increase in scope? But I have seen that before. So if you have an older site, you might have something like that at your site that you have to deal with.
Okay. We had a quick question about EPA's letter to Congress for the five-year review. Will that incorporate state agencies' concerns and comments?
No, I don't believe it does. It's a very, I think it's more like numbers. There were X many five-year reviews done at this many sites. This is where we did independent findings. So it's not a detailed report to Congress with concerns identified. It's very high level.
Okay. We have a question about situations where they have a site and recommendations were not implemented over a significant period of time, like a decade or more. They are aware that they can write a letter, but they're wondering what else they might be able to do or to take in a situation like that.
So you have your five-year review. Maybe it's a second or third five-year review where you've made a recommendation and nothing has seemed to happen on that yet. This does happen. I would say it's not unheard of. Yes, you can issue a letter, but I think it really comes down to the nature of the recommendation. Is it identifying a problem with protectiveness? Is there an immediate threat to human health or the environment? In those cases, I would say look at your federal facilities agreement and see where there is the opportunity to raise issues for either informal dispute or formal dispute. That's where you get back into a process where these concerns can be addressed. The five-year review, as I said, you're just raising a flag, but it doesn't have a lot of teeth. It's not a hard hammer that you can take if you're in disagreement, but look at your federal facilities agreement. That will have more tools that are available to you.
Yeah, and I think the key question to ask yourself is it really an issue and recommendation at that point, or is it sort of fundamentally impacting the protectiveness of the remedy? And so is it really even protective?
Okay. How about the case where one regulatory agency approves a remedy ROD, but the other does not?
So I'm assuming you mean a disagreement between EPA as a federal regulator and the state regulator.
Yes.
So remember, you can't have a record of decision without EPA approval. The EPA signature needs to be on that ROD. So if EPA disagrees with the remedy that's being identified for the preferred one by the state, they're not likely to sign up to that. However, it all comes back to partnership and collaboration. What's the big difference? Can the agencies work together to get, you know, on the same page about what the selected remedy should be for that site? Hopefully you're not, you know, you've drafted your ROD, your proposed plan already went out for public comment and you're like, hey, we don't agree. Oof, you really should have had that conversation during your RIFS when you're, or your FS specifically, when you're looking at those alternatives and really discussing which ones have concerns as a state agency or which would be supported. So have that conversation early and continue to have it throughout the CERCLA process.
And I think many times the states are signatories to our FFA, so mm-hmm. that gives them the opportunity to elevate the site through the dispute process since a decision mm-hmm. document, like Record of Decision, is a primary document.
Okay. Related to that, if EPA and the lead agency disagree on other elements, let's say levels of change in a ROD, mm-hmm. does EPA's position prevail?
So I'm thinking the question is asking if you're trying to determine if the level of change means you need an ESD or if mm-hmm. it means you need a ROD amendment.
Correct.
So in that case, conversation again, collaboration, partnership with your team is super important because as far as issuing an ESD, the lead agency cannot go forward and issue that ESD on its own. There's no executive order that gives that kind of authority. It still needs to be done in conjunction with EPA. So I would say work on it until you do agree. I have seen times where something is being proposed as this is an ESD. We'll just write it up, put the notice in the public paper, and we're good to go. And as a regulatory agency, you're really looking at it, scope, cost, performance, and saying this is actually a fundamental change. It's not appropriate to issue as an ESD. We need to have public comment and a longer process to get to a final decision here. So let's work together and try and get there together. And hopefully these conversations are not happening on the 11th hour. But again, if it's not significant and it's fundamental as a regulator, stick to that and explain why you're coming to that conclusion. And that could be something that goes up for dispute through your FFA as well. And then you get to higher levels of management until a decision can be made if the site team is just not getting there with it.
Okay. An earlier question came in, and again, there seems to be a lot of interest in EPA's role in federal facilities. And so this participant noted that we keep repeatedly referencing EPA's role on federal facility sites, but they say that some federal facilities appear to not have any participation from EPA. And they want to know what determines whether a federal facility process includes EPA or not. So, I mean, I want to be sure very clearly if that happens or it just is an appearance and EPA is involved and it may not be as visible to them.
So for federal facilities that are on the national priorities list, those are going to require a federal facilities agreement where EPA and the lead agency are signed on to. And usually the state signs on to those FFAs as well. There's a few states that don't. But again, those are federal facilities on the NPL site. If you're talking about FUDs, formerly used defense sites, that is handled by the Army Corps of Engineers for Department of Defense. And in those cases, EPA does not have a role in that process. That's done separately. John, does that hit it right?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Okay. And then again, just for clarification, for federal facilities, who writes the ROD, EPA or the lead agency?
So the lead agency gets money from Congress to do cleanup at the site, meaning they have larger resources to hire contractors and write these very, usually very technical, very long decision documents. So it really falls to the lead agency to draft that record of decision. You have a single EPA RPM typically working with their counterparts at the federal agencies and a whole like fleet of contractors. So it's just a matter of resources at that point.
Okay. All right. We did have a comment here that that there's also tribal consultation on ESDs mm-hmm. as well. And I don't know if you can comment or add anything to that.
We have a course on tribal consultation and coordination. So definitely take that if you're interested in having more of that conversation. But tribal consultation, that requirement falls to the lead agency. Regulatory agencies can still engage with the tribes, coordinate with the tribes to hear their concerns, have technical discussions with them, whatever they may need to better understand what's happening at a site. But that requirement really falls to the lead agency to conduct.
Okay. All right, Emmy, it is about 5 minutes to three, and I know there are some closing reminders, and I'm looking at a lot of other questions that are coming in that seem to be very well in this situation. What would you do? So I'm going to turn the floor back to you for just some closing commentary, as well as how they can follow up with more questions before I pop back on for those closing reminders.
All right. Well, again, everyone, thank you so much for joining us today. I hope you've learned a little bit about RODS and other decision documents. If you have questions, feel free to reach out to me. John, we can make his information available. Mary and Monica are also very good resources as well in our federal facilities office if you'd like to reach out. If it is a super site-specific question, our answer is likely going to be talk to the EPA RPM first before coming to headquarters to get an answer. But if it's a question of policy, guidance, where you could find more information, I'm happy to help. Go ahead and shoot me an email.
All right, excellent. Thank you so much, Emmy. I'm going to go ahead and pop up a few final reminders for our participants today. And if you joined us a little bit late, I'll just remind everybody that today's session was part of the ongoing Federal Facilities Online Academy. So this was session number 2. There will be a total of 11 webinars that will be taking place online that are open to the public. So you may register and participate in any or all of those webinars. You can either take them live when we host them online, or you can actually replay the recorded versions that will be posted on the CLUIN archived webinar page. For each one of those sessions, you can fill out our feedback form and check a box to request a participation certificate for each one of those 11 sessions. So you can get a certificate for all 11, again, whether you're there live or you replay them. And then for those that are eligible, there's also a 3-day in-person training that is open to EPA, states, tribes, and other federal agencies. So if you are eligible and able to take that in-person class and also complete all 11 of the online classes, you'll then be eligible for our Academy certificate. So you have to do all of the online classes and that in-person class. If you can't do the in-person class, then you are not eligible to get the Academy certificate, but you can still get those individual certificates for the webinars that you choose to participate in. I'm going to go through just a few quick other reminders. Remember, these sessions are being hosted through the Cleanup Information Network, so I encourage you to visit us at CLUIN.org and sign up for Tech Direct. It's our free monthly newsletter that I send out on the first of each month, which will highlight webinars like today's session that are open to the public. Now, as I pointed out, there is an Academy homepage, and I apologize, it is not the number 1 at the end, it is the number 2 on the end of it. I will send everybody a follow-up email with that correct homepage URL at the end, but on that homepage is where you'll find contact information for our presenters. There is a tab that's sort of running right underneath the title on that homepage. You can download the participant manual, which contains the slides and all of the supplemental notes, and then browse through a whole collection of related links that the instructors have put together. And then on that page, you'll also find the feedback form button. So if you click the link to the feedback form, you'll have an option to let our instructors know what you thought of the delivery. And please know they do read each and every submission. And at the very bottom of that form, there is a box you can check to certify you were here for the entire live delivery or you replayed the whole thing. And then if you check that box and submit your feedback form, you will then have access to a certificate of participation that you can save for your own records. There'll be an option to download it on the submission screen. And then we should also email a copy. I always advocate that you download a copy from the screen after you submit it, because sometimes the emails get stuck in junk or spam folders. If you don't check that box when you send in your feedback, you won't get a certificate, and then we'll have to kind of manually go in there and regenerate it for you. So please be sure to check the box when you're filling that form out. If you happen to share the line with multiple people and had others watching at your location, you can simply give them the link to that feedback form and each person can fill it out and check the box and get their own participation certificate, even if they didn't register individually for the session. And if you happen to be one of the lucky ones replaying today's recorded session, you should still be able to access that participation certificate by filling out the feedback form. Again, noting it's not a one for today's session, the URL ends in a two. So if you go to this URL but change the one to a two, you will also find that button to the feedback form. You can fill it out and still get a certificate based off of your replay of the recorded version. And right now in the recorded version, there is likely a button above my video in this recorded version that as you're replaying the recorded session, you can also click and access that feedback form. But if you don't see it, just go to the URL, noting that change should be a two at the end. With that, I will send out a follow-up email here as soon as the archive is available for you to replay on demand. We'll also include the link to the feedback form in that email as well. I want to thank our organizers and all of our attendees who joined us for today's live session. We really appreciate your involvement. And we'll go ahead and formally conclude today's session. I hope that I'll see you connecting on a future Clue In webinar. With that, this will be the formal conclusion to today's live session. Thank you so very much.